Hi there, welcome back to the Think Curiously podcast. Today I am delighted to be speaking to a fellow Northern Irishman who's not in Northern Ireland at the minute, he's out in the States, that's Gary Kiernan. And if you're not part of coaching, you're not part of football circles, you might not be aware of the work that he's done or what he's doing. So hopefully as we go throughout that, you'll get an idea of it. But the idea of the podcast episode itself is to talk about this idea of building a career, focusing on what sacrifice is, focusing on how we overcome obstacles and how we view failure, basically. So, Gary, it's very good to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Gary. Yeah, excited to get on there, finally.
Excellent. We've been talking for a wee while back in the background to try and get this sorted, so I'm happy we finally got a time to do it. So, Gary, for those listeners that aren't aware of who you are and what you do, can you just give us a little bit of background into you?
Yeah, so I was born in Omagh, Northern Ireland. I've been in America for almost 20 years, 21 years. I've now lived in America longer than I lived in Northern Ireland. Came over here when I was 18, to college, did the college soccer, played over here, and then moved on to the coaching side. So the accent is hanging on for dear life at this stage. That's why I jumped on this podcast, to try and talk to someone from Northern Ireland to get some of it back. But I've coached in college for 10 years and then moved into the women's professional game, and I'm currently working in Louisville with the team here. So working with senior players now and then working with college, but I've been in the game for in the coaching aspect of the game for about 15 years. So passionate about it and excited to come on and talk.
Excellent. I was actually going to give you credit for your accent because it is quite strong still. So I can only speak from my own experience. I was out in for 2010, 2013, and I came home and I think I got stuck for about 2 years after it because I couldn't get rid of some of the nuances of the accent. So all credit to you.
I work with a dairy man here, Christy Holly, and his accent is like, he's done really. We go out and people are like, oh, how come you don't have an accent as strong as he has? So I put in some extra work in it over the last 6 months.
I think you have to try and keep that authenticity, right? That's key. So I guess just the first kind of topic that I want to try and discuss is the idea of sacrifice in terms of how we view sacrifice to build a career for ourselves. Because you said there that you've spent more time living in America than you have in the country you were born in. And to a great extent, leaving Northern Ireland at 18 years of age, going to somewhere that you possibly never been to, didn't really know much about or didn't have any contacts. So how did you find that leap when you first went out?
I really struggled. Came over, I was 18. And to be honest, like I had worked probably in the last 2 years from 16 to 18, I had worked really hard to get to America on the college. I would send hundreds of emails, and email had just started back then, showing me age here. So it was almost like I really committed to trying to get to America. I really wanted to come over here and play. My initial ambition as a player was to, like every kid growing up in Northern Ireland, was to get to England and become a professional. And once you realize that that's not going to happen, then it becomes, right, well, what's plan B? And my grades were good enough, and I really loved America. I went here on holidays when I was 14. So when I came over, I had an idea of what it was going to be like, and it was completely different. I really, really struggled with homesickness for probably about 6 months, to the extent that it was, if there had been an airport nearby with access to get there, I probably would have, if it was up to me, I would have jumped on the plane. Every day I called home. Most days I cried my eyes out. I was fortunate to have an initial support system over here that with friends that I went to college with that were going through a similar experience. So I had a couple English guys, had a head coach from Belfast who helped me. And my messaging from my parents was like, just get to next week, get to next week, get to next week, hang in there. And then once I came home and first Christmas and came back again, I was flying. But that 6 months was really, really difficult, and it impacted my soccer. So I learned a little bit. Probably hadn't been through adversity to the extent of that there. and then wasn't really realizing that I was going through. So in looking back, it taught me a lot. But after that, there, year by year, I think once you get through the initial, am I missing anything from back home, and you get through their family, then it becomes easier. And, you know, right now I look at it as something that was really, really character building.
Yeah, I guess I can relate to that experience because I'd been there in 2010 myself. But I think what's key to what you've just said is you find people in a similar situation to that were out there, and you find that connection. And it was almost that, I would suggest, that group camaraderie in many ways that helped you through that, and a shared experience. So a shared experience of going through very similar emotions.
100%. Yeah. And I think that's where, I mean, it was 1999. Like, I don't think, and I don't know whether mental health, self-awareness, all this stuff, like, we weren't really aware of, we didn't talk about feelings, and you know, it was a different world back then in so many different ways. So I think for me to go through, sometimes you're just going through things that you didn't know about. Like, you're waking up and you're just thinking you're in a bad mood and you need to snap out of it. And sometimes, as harsh as that sounds, that was what the support group was about with the boys. You know, being from Northern Ireland, I think humour plays a big, big role in our lives that we don't really realise how much we need it. So when you're around people who can make you laugh, yeah. And that was something that I still keep in touch with the guys that I think we were North. I went to school in North Carolina, and you know, I had been to America and Florida, so I'd done Disney World. I'd also done New York City, so, and I thought both. Well, North Carolina will be a little blend of both, and it was like, I thought it was like going to, it was the American version of Oma. You know, it was like green fields and nothing there, and it was a lot different culture, different culturally, and seeing the South. Like, the South is a different world, and probably whenever you're in different parts of America, it's this cool, like, oh, you're from Ireland, oh, that's really cool. Well, parts of North Carolina, like, they don't think it's as cool to come from Ireland, so you're like, you don't actually like my accent. So things like that there, you look back and laugh, but it was really good, yeah, to have a group that were going through the same thing.
Yeah, and I also think that, just picking up on what you said there about your parents, you know, saying get to next week, you know, always saying, you know, the easy option for them would have been is to book you a flight, get you back home, because you weren't, you know, maybe at that time fitting in as well as you thought, and it would have been an easier option for you to jump on the plane and go. Maybe because if the airport, as you said, was a bit closer, that might have been something. But what I like about that is the fact that, you know what, your mum and dad at that stage were doing what was right for you. And I guess the reason I want to pick up on that point is because we come from what we call our wee country. Mm-hmm. And I've had this discussion with a friend of mine for quite some time now. I think we disadvantage ourselves by calling it our wee country. Because when we leave and we go to a bigger country, a bigger city, I think there's a negative connotation that's attached to the idea of it being we. Mm-hmm. And that we don't belong because it's this big metropolis that we've just got ourselves into, and it doesn't feel right. And it's easy for us to draw comparisons to what's going on at home. And then because you do that, you come out, you recruit back in, or sorry, you withdraw back into yourself and your comfort zone. And you kind of, you look for things that are going to be easy for you. Whether that's right or wrong, whether it's theatrical, whether it's some kind of psychological theory behind that, I'm not sure, but that was a discussion I had with my friend. And I guess part of your journey has been that, if you want to call it stickiness, that grit, that, you know, to get to next week, to use mum and dad's phrase, to keep going.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, I think I've talked about this with Christy Holly a fair bit. Like, I think Northern Ireland generally were brought up with a little bit of an inferiority complex with ourselves. So, and I think a lot of that is because our humility is probably our biggest strength as a community, as a country. So, because you just can't get bigger than, like, people keep you grounded so much at home. Sport keeps you grounded. Social settings keep you grounded. But then I also think the dynamics of Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland, you know, you don't really have this, like, patriotism that is evident in America or England. So whenever you go across to overseas, and this is what I experienced, is, you know, you're not really comfortable, and you're, even the accent isn't, you know, you it's not the cool Dublin accent, or it's the cool London accent that's Northern Ireland. So you're constantly thinking, and I've now grown up and living in America so long, people are so confident in who they are. But when I was growing up in Northern Ireland, we were just always thinking that America was, people were faster, smarter, and stuff like that there. And I think, it's held like modest or humility and awareness is a great trait, I think, for us to teach our kids in Northern Ireland. But sometimes when you're going away, it can hold you back a little bit.
Yeah, I just think back to a few kids that I know over the last number of years who, as we call it here in Northern Ireland, go over the pond, go across the water to England, and they struggle with the social scene. They struggle with not either two things, I think. One, not being the bigger fish, I think is huge, because we've only got a select pool over here to choose from. But that if you then take that person out of Northern Ireland and you put them in the middle of Manchester, Liverpool, London, Newcastle, all those big cities, there's probably going to be three or four players that will be in around their level, if not better. So there's that part of it, which I don't think we do very well. Not just football wise. I'm talking, you know, across the board, life wise, in terms of life skills. I don't think we teach our kids that resilience, that mental, I don't want to say toughness, but the ability to look at a situation, think, right, how can I make this better for myself, rather than how can I get out of it? How can I embrace it?
Yeah, you definitely need, I think you need a long term approach. Like, again, like I think with soccer players coming out of Northern Ireland, you know, you're going to be up against it in Europe. So across, you're going to be up against it in England, because you've got you're playing against people who have been probably exposed to better facilities and more regular football. But the weather in Northern Ireland means that, and the setup just with the clubs means that you're probably training once, twice a week, if that. So like for me coming to America, the level wasn't anywhere near what it would be in England. But like physically, I was miles away from an American player at 20, 18, 19. But I by being in a full-time environment for 2 years, started to see that I started getting better and getting stronger. And that's where I think that it's difficult, because to stay in something for 2 years and take a long-term approach makes sense in theory. But when you're in that there, you get, sometimes it's being kicked for 2 years mentally. And that's where sometimes you do need that support system. And sometimes that's where it becomes difficult, where you almost have an identity crisis, because if you're constantly questioning that people are better than you, it's very, very hard for you to make that up in the long term. So it's definitely a mental challenge.
Yeah, I also think that individual responsibility is huge. You know, you take responsibility for your actions. So again, I can only talk about my experience of when I was in the States. I knew one person when I was out there, only because I'd been emailing them to say that they'd pick me up at the airport. So I literally got on the flight at Belfast International. I remember my dad was out playing golf, and I remember ringing him and he didn't pick up, and I got a little bit emotional about it. I was like, because I wanted to speak to him before I got on the plane. And then I got on the plane. Obviously you can't ring when you're on the plane. Got to America, the phone wouldn't work to ring back home. So I'm literally sitting in the middle of Newark International Airport looking for this guy with peach blonde hair. That's all I knew. Right, I'm looking for the crest, the club crest in his chest, and a peach blonde hair, because that's all I knew of him. And I remember being driven from the airport in the car to the accommodation I was staying at before I headed in onto Massachusetts. And I was just asking 100 million questions. When can I get a phone? When can I get a bank account? When can I get this? When can I do that? So it was interesting how my mindset switched from wanting to ring my dad to landing in the airport and now thinking, right, I'm here, so I've got to try and do something about it. And it's not something I ever worked on. I'm not giving myself praise for that. I'm just saying that's how I thought about it, how I kind of internalized it. And maybe the approach of taking responsibility and it being taught at a younger level, younger age over here, and what that means, it might actually help people who decide to even head to London and head to Dublin for a career, rather than always thinking that. I was told when I left, my uncle said to me when I left, he said, don't worry about anything in Coleraine, because when you come back, it'll be the exact same time. Mm-hmm. You know, so I did come back, so it didn't work. But what I was saying, what I was getting at, there was this idea of individual responsibility and how we take responsibility for our actions. I think that's huge.
100%. Yeah. And that comes from, again, like I think education in Northern Ireland is, I argue with my wife all the time, is way better than a lot of what we do over here. We try to remember and we try to a lot of true false and a lot of quite, you know, like you don't really learn, but Northern Ireland, yeah, in the education system, I think we learn to, you know, a lot of writing, a lot of critical thinking. So when doing that there, you're engaging the brain, or you're reflecting on things. And then I think with just the family structure at home, it's generally there is tough love, you know, in a certain way with sport as well. It's like you're kind of used to big, like, tough pitches, tough weather. Yeah, coaches that might yell at you the odd time. So you get used to, you know, you get used to life and not being a bit perfect. And when I start to see, obviously with my kids at the minute, and they're probably going to go into sport the next couple of years, there's things that I wish that they would experience because that's what I did. But yeah. It's definitely makes you think.
And I guess have initially got over that, have initially, as you said, you went back at Christmas, then came back again, that was you over it. That's you kind of focus now on getting that career that you were dreaming of football wise. And then there was a transition between football, playing it and actually coaching it, obviously. But along that road, there had to have been certain sacrifices that you had to make to get to that point, right? So for example, I spoke to Conor Marlin last lockdown. We've done an interview with him, and he was talking about, you know, when he went to try and make his way in coaching over here, he was traveling from one side of the country to the other side of the country, paying out his own pocket, his own petrol money. He was missing out on social events at the weekend with his family and his friends. He was putting all of this in because he knew what the potential end product of all of those sacrifices would be. And I think he became the youngest A-licence coach here in Northern Ireland, and he's now director of coaching at Oldham Athletic. So that has paid off for him in the long run. So would you say during that period then where you were making the transition from playing to coaching, there would have been a lot of sacrifices that you had to make to try and make that leap work?
Yeah, in one regard, like socially, it was similar to what Connor's experience was. Like I was still working. So I came from playing at the university to working at the university in like a month once I graduated. And the way that the culture is over here is that once you make that leap onto the staff, is that there's no social, obviously not with players, but even through undergrads. So like you almost cut the cord of like your nightlife and your social life and all that there. You can't really, you know, you're living in a campus because there's still student housing that you're still living at, but you can't hang out with anyone. So for me, I struggled. That was at 22 to 24. And you're still like in touch with all your friends at home. So they're going out four nights a week and you're working. You know, I was, my mentorship was under Gary Hamill, who was the coach initially, Belfast man. And his was, he taught me the value of like probably extending coaching from the pitch onto the office. And you're looking at, you're in at 9 o'clock and you're leaving at 6-7 o'clock. And that was every day. And it was, so coaching became a 9-to-5 job. So, but I like, honestly, during that stage, I didn't really, it wasn't something that I viewed as a sacrifice. It was something that I probably was ready for it because I was just passionate about the game. I needed probably something a little bit different. So once I started looking at the game from a different lens, I didn't think I wanted to become a coach. And then I started getting my feet wet and started taking some coaching courses. And then I just remember those years of my life being so keen to, like, the days just flew because it's something I hadn't experienced before.
Yeah. And again, just drawing back to conversations I've had in the past, one with Connor, but then one with a friend of mine who's just left to go out to the States. Well, I say just left, it was before lockdown last year, but, and they were, both of them said something very similar, and it kind of hit me between the eyes, and I thought, oh, actually, they're quite right. Was as, along the same lines you said, you weren't quite aware that the sacrifice you were making at that time were actually sacrifices, but both of them had made it very clear that when they had that kind of tunnel vision, if you like, the blinkers on to suggest that that was what they always wanted to do, they always wanted to coach, and they always wanted to go forward with it, it almost became that without it, they felt a little bit of, their little bit of identity wasn't really there. There was something missing. So the very fact that they weren't aware they were making sacrifices was actually a positive. But then when they didn't have the game, or they were out of work, or they were, you know, searching in between games, they realized how important it actually was to them. And then that made them even more aware of sacrifices, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Like, I think that's the thing with being a coach, and that's something that I think my wife has no interest in football. So that helps me. But also, like, where she gives me perspective on, maybe holds a mirror up every now and again. Like, she thinks that I have an unhealthy relationship with football. And at the start, I thought, no, that's not. She's talking rubbish. But now I actually think it's correct, because I think to work full time and to be ambitious in the game, I do think that it has to define your identity. And if you let anything define, and that's where, and I see people online saying, like, yeah, your job doesn't define you. But in football, you're always in extremisms. Like, you're always pushing the limits, and you're always trying to get, it's just such an industry, because it's a passion and it's a job, and you merge those together, that it's always going to become part of your identity. So I don't actually think that you can, you know, you can have the person and the coach. I think the person and the coach will always come together. And even, like you mentioned, Kenny Shields there, I'm sure Kenny, when he views himself, his self-image as probably, like, he's a football man, like, that's who he is. And that's where I kind of go back then to people at home, and you do have those. So yeah, it is unhealthy, but it's also, it does kind of pull you up by the straps of the boots sometimes to get you going, and sometimes you need that.
What is the crack, people? I apologize for interrupting the podcast, but I wanted to let you know about Patreon and what Patreon is. Patreon is a way that I can keep this podcast fully independent. And what independence means for a podcast is that I can talk essentially about what I want with who I want, and I can produce it in whatever style that I want to, because I'm not succumbing to the pressures of any outside influence or any sponsors who may be sponsoring the podcast and telling me that I've got to speak about specific topics. So it gives us full diversity and creativity, and we can be as flowing and as free and as moving with it as we need to be. How you can do that is you can support the podcast. All I'm asking for is just a little bit each month. It's a cost of a coffee or a cost of a pint, really. It's £3.50 per month, and I know not a lot of people agree with it because they've seen me out and had a pint before, and I'm sure they don't want to buy me any pints. But if I was in the bar and you're listening to my podcast beforehand, would you go into the bar? Would you then see me? Would you then buy me a pint? If the answer is yes, surely head over to patreon.com/thinkcuriouslypodcast and send us just the price of a pint, because there's a lot of effort goes into the production of these podcasts, and I truly hope that you do enjoy listening to them as much as I enjoy making them. And that whole process does have a little bit of a cost to it, so all I'm trying to do is just get paid for the work that I do, really, and that small amount each month will essentially help. But the great thing about Patreon is it's a community. We can all help each other out, because I do understand that not everybody will be able to afford it, and if you can afford it, that's great, and your help will be appreciated, and I really do mean that. But if you can't, it's okay, because those who can afford and those who do then pay allows you then to still get it for free. Everyone is a winner. So head over to patreon.com/thinkcuriouslypodcast. All of your support will be truly appreciated. You can get all the information over there, as well as heading into any of our social media pages. You'll get the links across any of the posts that have been up recently. There'll be a video on there telling you how to do it and a little bit more information about it. But I guess I wanted to jump on in the middle of this episode just to remind you about patreon.com/thinkcuriouslypodcast. And with that, let's get back to the show.
I often wonder, you know, as coaches and teachers, or in whatever walk of life it is, when you get someone who, a player or a student who you can see real potential in, and you just know that there's things that they should let go, there's things that aren't really being a positive impact to them, and they may look upon them as being potential sacrifices. How do you change their mindset? Because that's a big interest of mine, particularly in the last 2 years working with young adults, 18s and 20s, is to see them and go, you know what? Yes, you do have the trajectory. It looks as if technically and tactically you do have the ability to potentially make the jump to the first team and look to cement a place there. However, there's the job that you're doing isn't really giving you any help in terms of the Saturdays you have to work, or, you know, so it's like, how do we make that lesson applicable to the players or people under our charge, really? And how do we show them that's important?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, it's something that like I think communication, I think, is something that I think if in this generation of player, if you are people that if you tell them what to do and you take the ownership of it, you probably will get the opposite. You'll probably have them going the other way. They'll either disengage or they'll just basically remove themselves from from doing what you want. But I think you have you've got this relationship based leadership, which I think is really, really important to where you're actually, I think it's really important because you're actually going to get their ear. But then I think once you get their ear, you're trying to then engage them in potential solutions. And that's where, and I don't mind that as a coach, to where, you know, you're sitting with a 22, 23 year old and you're saying that, even tactically, you're saying that, you know, this is going really well, but you're framing it different. Whereas in my day, it would have been, you need to do this, but now it's, how do you feel about this? Or you're being a bit more deliberate about your language, or maybe you're being a bit more deliberate about follow-up, or when it comes to solutions, maybe you're incorporating somebody else. So maybe it's that player that, maybe if they need more in the gym and you've got a resource there, you're like, hey, listen, you're reaching out to someone. Just there last week, we were talking as a staff about a player and how to get a little bit more out of a player. And you're looking at incorporating, well, who does she look up to? And can you impact the social structure to impact the player? So it's almost as a coach today, you're probably doing more, but you're also then seeing where you can lend a little bit of it. So you have to be so, I would say you have to be more creative about solutions, because if you want, and that's where the humility piece comes in. If you think you can solve every problem in this year, you're not, because some of the players just generally won't think that you're the go-to person. So maybe you have to work in the shadows, or maybe you have to maneuver around getting other people involved. It's definitely a tricky one, because then everyone's different, and then there's pressure, timing, and all that stuff as well.
Well, I love that. I love the idea of that relationship led intervention. I don't, that's not the words you use, but it's the words I was kind of getting when you were speaking. But because we spoke briefly before we came on about the High Performance Podcast and Gareth Southgate's episode, and obviously on the back of what happened on Sunday and the journey that team has been over the last 4 weeks, there has been a lot of, in the past, there's been a lot of negatives associated with the England setup and with what they were doing in terms of the press and coverage from the media, certain individuals in the team not buying into the way they wanted to play, the way they wanted to behave. So that current crop of players seems to be as if Gareth Southgate has got through to them in a way that, you know, when you're with me for the next 6 or 7 weeks, here's how we want to operate, but we let you have your input. You can see that through the inflatables in the pool and things like that. From the outside looking in, it looks as if he's got players in the right mindset to understand that this is a positive for the full team. And I guess where I was going with that was that if each individual in a team environment is making very small sacrifices to how they, their lifestyle, for example, to sleep patterns, to whatever it is they eat, then eventually, if you're looking after a team, whether that's a team of people or a team of players, those small changes and sacrifices are going to have a massive impact.
100%. Yeah. I think we overuse this word buy-in today. And almost as a community, coaching community, we hide behind it a little bit because, you know, well, they're not bought in, or they're like, I would flip it and say that I think for a team to be successful, environment to be successful, you need everyone to be, it needs to be individually driven in terms of everyone. And I think as a coach, you need to be upfront and clear with yourself and your staff from the, everyone has value and everyone is only going to engage in a process if it benefits them. So you have to make it you can see that engagement in England, and you can see it now in clubs. I'm starting to see it just from an observation standpoint with top managers, is that it's now where, you know, I just read one the other day of a Leeds player that joined Leeds from Italy. And it was, a part of the sale was that we can make you better. And I think once the people see that there's value in them as individuals, in terms, not just like they'll be respected, but you'll actually improve here, and here's how we're going to do it, and there's how the team's going to improve. And then you're then making the environment as aligned as possible. Do as all the messages connect. And I think sometimes environments, that's where they slip up. to be like, they actually don't, you know, they're saying, well, we're hardworking, we're all together, but you watch them train and, you know, there's not a lot of sweat happening out on the training pitch. And so I think sometimes you can, you know, you want to be able to get the alignment right. And I think maxing out individuals, I think it's an individual game. I really do. And that's where I see, like, Southgate's been unbelievable.
I agree with that. And I suppose the other point of what I was trying to say, but the Southgate scenario was the fact that when you look to create connections within groups, either between individuals or between groups of people, it's no secret that storytelling is quite a powerful tool to do that. And one of the stories that I always tell to any team that I've come across, and the only one I ever remember it working well with was an under 12 side, if I'm honest. So I keep battering the same drum, but that's a good thing or not. Anyway, I like the story, but it's about Dani Alves. And I read it about 5 years ago and it blew my mind. So he was interviewed. He'd won his 34th major title or major trophy of his career or something like this. And afterwards, a journalist was asking him about, where does he get this drive from to keep going, to keep pushing boundaries? And he told a story that when he was younger, his dad would be up at 5 a.m. on the field spraying toxins on the crop and whatever it may be. And the school that they went to, him and his brother went to, was 12 miles away from where they lived. So when there only was one bike in the family. And in order to get that bike, both of the brothers had to get up early in the morning, go out on the field and work with their dad. And then their dad decided which one of the two was working hardest. And then that one got the bike. But the incentive there was that the pickup game of football in the village started after school. So in order for them to get home in time to play the game, they had to have the bike, or they had to run 12 miles home. And I used that little storytelling with under 12s, like I said at the time I had. And it got home because I remember we had a conversation about the idea of being driven by boots and being driven by all the tangible stuff that you can wear, the shin guards and all this kind of stuff. And kids really buy into that, don't they? They really buy into that sort of social bonding, that circle. I've got the best boots, I've got this boots. And I was trying to make the point that, you know, it doesn't matter what boots you have. It doesn't matter what shin guards you have. It doesn't matter what, if your top's Adidas or if it's Patrick with two stripes that we used to have back in the day. That doesn't make a difference. What makes a difference is what you do every day you come to training. So I told that story. And then a few sessions later, a kid came up and he was wearing his old boots, not the new boots he had got, the old boots. I didn't question it. I let it go. And then after the session, I was like, you were on fire tonight. What was going on? He goes, oh, it's my old boots. I think I feel more comfortable in them. And I was like, right. And he says, oh, and my new boots, he says, I'm putting them away because I don't quite think I need them yet. Wow. And I was just like, whoa. And that story really hit home for me.
Yeah.
But in terms of the sacrifice element of it, when you can tell stories like that, I think it really has importance and has a real ability to bind and connect people and teams if you're looking to drive them on the same, a similar track.
100%. Like, as well, like, I always think as there's more coaches now, so kids are getting used to structured environments earlier and earlier. You know, when I was growing up, there wasn't really, the coach wasn't a technical coach. It was just a manager, a team manager and they were brilliant and they were enthusiastic. But now we've gone the other way. We've got more technical coaches and people are getting exposed to coaching at a younger age group and sometimes these like professional type environments. And I think that kids can become almost overcoached by the time they're really young, like 15, 16, 17, even at our level with senior players, you can say that like the aspects of the game, they've been used to this language for 10 years. So now you're always trying to just, how do you connect in a different way? And that's where I think maybe you said storytelling, maybe it's humor, maybe it's enthusiasm, things that we weren't really valuing in coach education. I think we're going to start to come into play more and more. I think the enthusiastic coach who maybe doesn't know A, B or C as well as somebody else can make more of an impact because there's just a real shortage of those people out at the minute.
Yeah, I agree with that. One of your stories on Instagram, was it yesterday you were asking a question about what was missing in coach education?
Yes, yeah.
So that's it. You've just answered it.
That's it. I mean, I think that's the personality of the coach. And I just see now we're just so serious. We're so brand aware. I just think the authenticity of a leader, and I see it every day, where like you're just trying to talk about relationships, but people don't want a, you know, they don't want a technician every day telling them that they want someone that they don't want a phone in their face. They want a little bit of authenticity. They want to feel energy. And like you talked about the performance podcast, and one of my favorite episodes is with Pochettino, because of his ability to feel people in terms of like what energy they bring, to take responsibility for your energy. I think sometimes as coaches, we put the cones out and then we think our job is done. But in reality, like the most important feel for the player is when they go out, they're going to see, right, well, most kids at most age groups are looking to see whether the coach is in a good form or not. Yeah. And if they're not, they're probably not going to be either. And some, like, I think that's something that we don't want to get away from, because I think if they lose the passion and energy of the game, I just don't think, the more I do this, the more I think like that's almost the X factor.
Yeah.
Because and that's where like Guardiola, Klopp, how long have they been doing this? And they still carry themselves with so much energy that's why people play for them.
I was out for lunch yesterday with a friend, and he's going to love this, because he said to me, if you have this chance to have this in a conversation, put it in there, and it's just perfect. He gave this analogy of a social battery. We were talking about coaching, and he says about his social battery. We're talking about primary ones. He works for the IFA in schools, and he was in the, and I said, I don't know how you could do that. I used to do that job. I couldn't do it now. I don't think I couldn't go in and coach primary ones. And he was like, you have to be aware of your social battery, how much of it is left, and how much can you give. If you're going to do a session and it's flat, then they're going to pick up on that and the session is going to be flat. Where if it's fully charged, you're going to have more energy and there's going to be more atmosphere about your session. You're going to get more connection with the players that way, and more connection with the people in your session. And I think it's a great way of thinking about it. But my question would kind of be in terms of moving away from the conversation on sacrifice towards sort of overcoming failure and adversity and things, is to finish off, is to say that my understanding anyway of, and I haven't got to any particular high level, I wouldn't say in massively, is the fact that if you set yourself a goal and you want to get there, you just don't look at what you need to do to get there. Look at what you need to avoid as well. And that's the biggest lesson I've had on sacrifice is that, yes, it's okay saying I've got to do X, Y, and Z. I've got to work 32 hours on the pitch so I can get my B license and do this from A license. But then what things do I got to give up? What things have I got to avoid that's going to help me get there? And you mentioned the high performance podcast. The one by Van Persie was perfect. We talked about his friend circle, wasn't it? I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, it's hard for young people today, again, to, you know, I think the social part of even life, especially in America, where they're getting used to it's very, very collective. Their experience in the game will generally be signed up at a very, very young age to go and play with teams. They'll play more games here before they're 16, I'm convinced, than any other country in the world, because the setup in youth soccer is just so professionalized. It's so clean. Pitches, balls, so everything's great from an operational standpoint. But then, does that then take away, or does that lend itself to social decisions where you actually don't want to be different? And everyone wants to be unique in a certain way. And there's, you mentioned the boots there. People can be unique and buy yellow boots, but Van Persie is unique in the sense that he can then sense that if I move in this direction, I'm just going to be part of this group. And that's self-awareness, motivation, whatever it is, at the highest level. And sometimes, and my kids are young enough. I have a 6-year-old or 5-year-old at the minute who's old enough to go into a soccer program, but I'm kind of holding back on it because I almost want him to want to go into it first of all. And that was like, for me, that's where I experienced the game. And that's where I think my passion comes from, is that it wasn't too structured early. And sometimes we do program. I don't know if that's real true or if it's just my perception.
I find that interesting because, again, I would be quite interested in the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, what really drives that player, what really drives that person. And I think that's a really good example of what you said there about your son wanting to having to want to play rather than you forcing him to play, and him making those choices himself. And it could essentially come back where he wants to play baseball, or he wants to play whatever other sport, basketball, for example, not football. And I think we can get very easily caught up in trying to, as football coaches as well, trying to push the kids and push those in our charge in a certain direction without physically saying, well, what's actually best for this person? Is it that somebody drops out of your sport at 16 but decides to go and play a different sport and can get to a higher level playing that sport than what they can play in your sport, but the best player in your team, so do you hold them back or do you let them go? You know, so that's where it comes back to the example of your young boy, is the fact that, well, if that motivation is intrinsic, if it's inside them, and they're not looking at that, at the medal, or they're not looking at the contract as the extrinsic reward for something that they've pushed so hard for, and it's all inside, it's the feeling, it's the emotion, it's what's attached to the process, I think is so much more powerful.
Massively. That's where I think intrinsic motivation has probably been. I don't really get caught up in defeats. I don't really get excited by wins. It's just because I don't place a lot of emphasis on any. Like, I haven't played, and I don't think I've coached at a massively high level. I just, anything that I've been successful with, I don't really have. Like, if it's a medal, I don't really, like, I would just give it, like, it's just a piece of silverware that doesn't really have much value for me. And the older I get, the more I move towards, you know, like, when you're now in coaching and you have to make decisions with financial decisions or anything out there, I would place a lot of emphasis on the experience of something and who that's with, or what you can, like, we were at a match on Friday night in Orlando, and it would have been a massive win for us, and we lost, and we tied. They drew, they scored the equalizer with about 10 seconds left, 6 minutes into injury time, and it was a gut punch. But the next day, when you're reflecting on it, you know, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, what a brilliant, like, to experience a low like that from such a high. Like, you're so fortunate to be able to do that there in football, still to be able to, like, a game that can take you emotionally places is worth so much, more than, you know, like a medal or anything you got there. Just the ability to get your emotions ripped out of you, you know, in a real safe way. Yeah. I wasn't thinking that at the time, but a day later I was thinking, that was brilliant, you know. And that's where football, I think sometimes we lose that as coaches. Sometimes, sometimes I think coach education, or maybe it was Jose's kind of way to change the game, was to put the coach at the top. I don't think the coach should be at the top. I think it's about, that's why I always post about old football and 80s yeah. football, because I just think the game was so more, not, it didn't have the extrinsic noise and motivation of what it does today. And I think, you know, we've got to be careful about that as coaches.
Yeah, I think that's why it's so much more important now that we focus, when we talk to players and we try and develop them, is that we're developing the ability for them to understand the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation and the value that it can give you. I came across this idea, and I've talked about it loads on the podcast, of the fridge door theory. I was reading a book, The Beginnings of Psychology, it was called. And it was going through, like, the very, very early theories of psychology, right up to, I think, 1980 something it was. It was gifted to me by a friend, so I thought I had to read it. Well, them ones, you know, I wasn't looking to read it, but it was gifted to me, so I read it. But anyway, what they'd said around 1960, I think it was, or so, this idea of the fridge door theory came into practice. So basically, where a child would come home and they would draw something at school or paint something at school, the first thing mum or dad would say, "Oh, that's great," and then put it in the fridge door. And then that, once that happened, it just continually happened throughout generations. And then nobody stops to question, hold on a minute, we are now praising the end goal, the product, and we're putting that up on the pedestal, and we're not discussing why they chose the color, why they chose the type of marker they did, the time and effort and everything that went into it, the process. And I guess that's a nice segue to the next sort of part of the episode, is talking about how we overcome adversity and failure. And a big part of that, I believe, is down to the growth mindset and the work of Carl Dweck. But if I were to just put it back on to you and ask you how important you think accepting failure is for development.
Oh, it's massive, massive. I was talking about some of this a few weeks ago. Like, I don't think I'm talented. I wasn't talented as a player. I don't see myself as that talented as a coach. But if I have one ability, one super strength, it's the ability to experience failure and not be rocked by it. Because and that's from a football standpoint. Like, I just think this game, as beautiful as it is and as much as I love it, I do think 90% of football is getting beat and getting a lesson and getting exposed or whatever it is. And I think the reality of, once you embrace that there, you can start to overcome it a little bit quicker. So I think failures for me is, like, I've lost games badly. I've lost changing rooms badly. I've been in situations where things have been really, really tough. It's made me grow, and it's made me change. And I think what I see is people is, we don't change as much, or we don't accelerate our growth unless we have to. And I think what failure gives you the opportunity to do is that it puts you in a situation where, if you're honest with yourself, you say either A, this isn't good enough, or B, I'm not happy and I need to change. So probably with my support system, and my wife has been brilliant with me. She doesn't care about football, but she cares about my happiness. So when she connects that you're not happy in an environment, that you're not happy doing something, then shake yourself up and do something about it. That's been for me. Like, I view my whole life as just, that didn't work, that didn't work, yeah, that didn't work, and that was rubbish.
I guess that's a real important lesson. And I know I like my anecdotes and like my stories, but I read Black Box Thinking a number of years ago by Matthew Syed, and Malcolm Gladwell also talks about it, about James Dyson. And I think the exact number, now I could be wrong with this, but I think the exact number was he had 1,247 prototypes of his vacuum before he succeeded. Like, when you've a thousand done, but you still think you're going to get somewhere. It's like that. But I guess it's also important that we're saying that we're not specifically setting out to fail. We don't want to set out to fail, but what we're saying is our attitudes to failure will allow us to develop. So I guess in terms of a connection piece with a player, or maybe somebody that you're giving advice to about failure, how would you kind of go about that conversation? Is it pure honesty? Like, this didn't work, here's how I think it should work. Or, as you mentioned earlier on, is it trying to get them involved in that solution development process in many ways?
Yeah, I've changed a lot on feedback in the last, since working with senior players. When I was a college coach, it was very much, here's feedback and how I see, or no, this is like technically what you're doing wrong, fix it or else you're not going to play. But now it's more, how I view coaching is that, like, it's my perception of a skill is not the, there are no rules that you have to strike a ball with your standing foot alongside it and your laces locked, or sorry, your ankle locked to put it in the top corner. You can do, you know, like, again, that's why I like looking at old football, because some of the greatest goals of all time were scored with, like, Maradona's goal with his hand was illegal, but at the end of the day, like, he just went and done it. Van Basten's goal, he should have squared it. Giggs's goal against Arsenal, should have squared it to Scholes. Romario's goal in 94 World Cup, he toe-poked it. Like, these things were, like, technically wrong, but they've produced some of the greatest moments of the game. Jordi, when Beckham scored against Wimbledon and the goal from the halfway line, there's the Jordi Cruyff is screaming for the ball, so, and he should have passed it to him. But, like, that's where you want the player to take a little bit of ownership. So yes, you can be a coach-led answer ABC, but you're going to risk losing other things. So for me, what I perceive is where I would start a conversation with a player now is I would always have video. So if I'm talking to a player, even if it's about training, I've probably invested more in the last 2-3 years of making sure I have information beside me to say what I'm seeing. Mm-hmm. I learned that in Chicago working with senior players when I rocked up to them and said, you know, in training yesterday, you did this and this. And I'm like, yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about. And that happened to me 2 or 3 times. And then I realized that actually they're only brave enough now to tell me that they had no idea what I'm talking about. It's not that I've been worse as a coach, but the college player couldn't say that they didn't know what I was talking about because I was signing their scholarship forms. So they just didn't have the bravery to say, listen, you're talking nonsense. So now I would say, right, what does the player see? Like, tell me what you see. So if there's 3 clips and there's a big mistake on 3 clips, and if it's not, like, if it's a one-off mistake, I don't really care. But if it's a trend where, you know, they're stepping too late and you get 3 trends in a game and you're like, all right, well, let's go and say, what do you see here? And they might say, I didn't step because I was worried about that space in behind. And that's something that I learned. I give these players, the senior players, a lot of credit from, if I see something that's a trend and it's not working, I always think that it's for a reason that I don't know about. Because if it's as obvious as you need to step there or you need to pass that ball there, I like to think that they would know that already if they're playing at this level. So I would then think, right, there's something in this here. I have to get their perspective. And once I get their perspective, if I see that as something that, oh, there's a flaw or there's a glitch or there's a gap here, then I would then see it as me saying, all right, well, again, how you deliver it as well. Hey, what about this? Have you thought about this? And then maybe you bring some more video in where it's a player doing this or that there. Maybe you follow up and maybe, again, you bring someone else in. But I think the complex of giving player feedback is, like, I'm actually doing it this morning. I'm breaking down a game. Every player get their clips in possession, out of possession. And then I put out a message on a group text that's, hey, the video clips are up. If you want to follow up, you follow up. You know where I am. But some of them follow up in different ways. Some of them will want to chat tomorrow. Some of them will want to chat the day before the next game. And I think you're just having to be a little bit careful, because I think at the end of the day, you want feedback to be something that they move towards rather than you chasing people. And that's something that, like, I always got frustrated as a college coach because people didn't look for feedback. But now I think about it, I'm like, is there any wonder I was hammering them?
They were too scared to come near you.
That's right. I was like, Roy Keane.
But I guess also, as you said there about, you know, knowing the players and you developing that approach over a number of years, the work of Carl Dweck, growth and fixed mindsets, is that something you think players are aware of? Or is it something that's slowly creeping its way into the game that we should potentially be, as coaches, promoting the idea behind it through our actions and through the way we communicate?
That's a great question. I don't think people are more aware. I think the psychology of the game is probably moving as slow. Like, I think tactically, conversations that you're now having with players at younger age groups in terms of systems, in terms of concepts, in terms of principles, you know, they're mostly, like, there's nothing much that really, like, oh, that's new. Like, most of them have exposure to that and understand, have a real good grasp of it. But I think growth mindset, attitude, consistency, things like that, I don't see as getting improving. And the reason why, actually, like, we talk about this a lot here, is the college system over here, and we're getting some players from some of the top schools, that I think you have to experience adversity regularly, actually, to be, you know. And I think that's where in the soccer system over here, if you're playing for the top team, you're probably winning 19 out of 20 games a week. So, and you also play Friday, Sunday, Friday, Sunday, Friday, Sunday. So you're playing 2 games. So if you lose on Sunday, you've got 4 days before you make it up again Friday. So you're not actually digesting a defeat. You're just dusting it off and go. And there's times that you have to dust things off. But if you dust off every setback and go again, then you're not really digesting what happened in it either, like, objectively as well. Like, I struggled in that game because ... And I think mentally, you know, it has to, again, like, it has to sting a little bit. So even with players today, like, I would say players today are, I think the skill set of understanding the concept of, yeah, the Carol growth mindset, I think everyone knows it in theory. I think contextually, does everyone know how it applies to our daily life? No, I don't think they do. And I think that's where it's something that, like, Christy Holly here always talks about if it's at present, if it's a defensive system, he always loops into his meeting that it's going to go wrong and that teams don't, you know, you don't press five times in a game and score five goals. And similarly, if it's an attacking exercise, you don't score all the time. You know, you only score one or two goals a game on average. So that, I think it's just something that as coaches we can, I think the mental piece is something that we maybe give ourselves too much credit for, but the external is definitely programming them. There's less conflict now. There's less setbacks in games. So maybe they're not getting as much of that as we would like to think.
Yeah. I also think that ego might be some part to play in it as well. As much as we all don't like to think that we think by ego and have an ego, we obviously all do it in some degree. And I guess when you're communicating with players, when you're communicating with people who you're looking to try and improve the performance on any kind of area, I think the what I've learned anyway, the biggest challenge is for the coach, one, not to be biased in terms of, I'll give an example. Whenever we have 18s, when I was working there, Darren would watch the opposition for the first 15 minutes. I'd watch us for the first 15 minutes, then we'd switch. So I knew that what I was seeing was what I wanted to see and what we were looking for in my team, 18s that were playing. But then whenever I switched to the opposition, because I was so focused on our guys, when I was looking at a blank slate, my biases weren't just quite as strong. Whereas if I was just purely focused on the game as a whole and looking at specific areas, my eye would be drawn to the left back, for example, because he had a bad week at training, or my eye would be drawn to our striker who's dropping off too much. And we've talked about this and I'd get frustrated on it. You know, so we tried to do things in the sideline that stop our biases from really coming to the fore. But when you give that feedback, when you're connecting with players and when you're talking about that, going back to the point, I think we have to be aware that, yes, they're going to be ego playing a part. We do have our biases, but if we have the facts and the figures, like you've said, when you're presenting to the players, it can keep you on task and the players realize that. I think without even using the words growth mindset or fixed mindset, you're starting to implement those behaviors and those bits of language into their vocabulary and how they think.
Yeah, 100%. And it's all like the more conversations you have with any person, the more that you're starting to appreciate their perspective and their understanding. And maybe then I do think that with senior players, definitely that there's a humbling aspect of it, to where, you know, you want to be able to give them the opportunity to tell you what they see. So you're not basically just marching into a situation or an experience. And I think as coaches, yeah, what data can definitely help you to what you're talking about there. Objective information can help you test your eyes. The majority, like video is the most humbling experience for me. I enjoy the fact that I watch a game and emotionally experience a game and draw conclusions about players and situations and then go back and watch it. And then it's completely different. and again, like I dread to think how decisions I made 15 years ago without any video or any data or any information based on my beautiful biases, and it would have been horrendous. But that's something that I think if you're then marching into a player, and that's where I think sometimes the community of coaching today, where it's like, all right, we're armed with our GPS or we're armed with our XG or whatever it is, and you're going and saying, like, I'm going to show this to the player. I think if the player is generally like, I don't like you, I'm not interested, that's like a foundation of, you're never going to overcome that. You're never going to get it. It doesn't matter whether you're showing them something good or bad. You have to be able to be like, all right, well, you know, we're not, you know, and that's where the professional level, you know, you're not friends with them, but at the same time, you want to keep all relationships positive. And that's where I try and do. And I'm really careful about when, and this is something, again, I've been a bit more aware of as I get older, is like, I want to be, when I challenge a player when I'm a more aggressive on the training pitch, I want to be I want to make sure that if I do raise my voice, or if I do, you know, challenge a player, I want to follow up on that. But I also want to be specific on when I can do that. So I don't do it the day before the game, because their heads are starting to get prepared for the game. And I definitely don't do it. I think our recovery day is the day after a game, when the reserves that didn't play come in. You know, I'll make sure that those players see the happiest version of me, and they'll never be challenged. They probably think I'm soft but that day is really important, because they're coming with emotion of disappointment, of maybe of a result, or disappointment of not playing. So I think you have to be aware of who the person is, but you also have to be aware of what they're going through. And this mindset of, well, hey, listen, do it, get on with it. Sometimes there's a place for that. Like if you have to go on the pitch in 5 minutes, you can't sit down and have a dialogue about what you're doing for set pieces. But sometimes when you have a coffee with a player, I think for any age group, I think if you're sitting down and saying, let's see what you're thinking, and let's see what you're experiencing, and you haven't been yourself, I think that's really positive today for people to build into their coaching.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, which kind of brings me on nicely to the final part of the episode, is all your experiences you've had over the years in terms of through the playing system, through the coaching system, both tech as well as the psychological stuff, has pushed you then now towards the creation of your modern soccer coach platform. I believe the books were the first kind of venture to that, and then the platform came second. Is that correct?
Yeah, the book started the books in 2013, started a book, and like always enjoyed writing, always enjoyed thinking about the game. So I don't know what it was, for some reason. I was working in Cincinnati at the time. I just decided to put something out. I didn't think that it was any, I saw the game moving in a different way, and I just wanted to put some ideas out. And then I wrote another one and another one, and then just started to put a bit more out. The podcast was something that I didn't really, and like most things, like I said about failure, like I would be that Dyson approach, put it out, get it, find out what's wrong with it, and then try and fix it. I try to be as consistent as I can with my content. Like at the minute, I'm trying to get, it's the first time probably in the last, I did the webinar stuff in the lockdown, but that was more or less because nothing else was happening. But now it's the website is just to get constant work up there. And for me, it's again, like a lot of people similar to yourself, Gary, like a lot of people have give up their time to come on to inspire you. And for me, I want to give, you know, there's part of it. There's books, and the books cost money, and there's a business model to it. But the majority of stuff I do is for free, because whenever there's even a few weeks ago, I had a challenge that I wanted to work through, and I reached out to a coach who I didn't think was going to respond, and I got on a Zoom with him within 24 hours, and it was mind-blowing how much it helped me. Mm-hmm. So I always think, like, at the core front of what I do, a lot of people, like, I think social media was brilliant 10 years ago for coaches. I think it was so much ideas, so much innovation. And now I think it's becoming a bit of just a little bit tired of seeing messages, a lot of people pushing different brands and stuff like that. And I think deep down, I think, you know, if you want to give people a perspective, and you want to give people an idea, and you want to give people maybe some information, I think that's what I still look at it as coaching, as that's where I can help.
Yeah, I can only say from someone who's used the platform and been on the platform how beneficial it was. The biggest thing for me was last year during lockdown, obviously whenever we couldn't be on the pitch, it almost, I remember sitting, was there one on defensive corners, was a set plays, you just jumped on one set.
Yeah.
And I remember actually I sat with a pen and piece of paper, and before the next sort of point you were making, I was writing, trying to write down, I was almost like trying to coach it in my head, if that makes sense. Because I felt that's the way I engage with things anyway. I always try and like to put my own little spin on it, but I thought, if I'm not being on the pitch, I need to train that part of my brain that thinks I'm on the pitch, you know, so it keeps that muscle growing, keeps it flexing and stuff. And that's why I connect it with it. And I actually, there was a PowerPoint. So what I do with my books, so before I start, if I read a book and I've got like a few key takeaways, I'll quickly jot it down, then I'll go to PowerPoint and I'll make a little PowerPoint of it. So it's for my own gain, you know? So if I know that I've seen something in the book Grit by Angela Duckworth, for example, I'll just go to the laptop, click on it and find that point and go, oh, that's what it is. So I've done the exact same thing with your webinars where I wrote my notes and then I put on the PowerPoint. And oh, I came across them. I came across the one on the Defensive Set Plays last week. And a friend of mine in Garth Porter up in Cookstown direction was looking some ideas on set plays. So I was like, well, this isn't exactly what Gary spoke about, but because it's my own notes, my own interpretation of it, but here's an idea. So I was able to do that and I keep it for my own sort of my own. And when I do it, I put the blue and white of Corrine as the diagram because it's more relative to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'm just in terms of the content and in terms of how I interacted with it, that's how I done it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like webinars, I actually had done a few webinars before the lockdown, and then just start again. I was with my family and like everyone else. So I got fortunate with a couple of guests that were kind of got the ball rolling, and then I just started doing. I was doing four or five. I was doing two a day some stage, and then probably around July I was starting up this job as well. And probably a few weeks before that, I thought that everyone had really kind of maxed out on like this growth area, and everyone was just a bit cheesed off with like being at home. So then I backed off and probably stepped away from it for about 3-4 months. But then I just find this myself is like I subscribe to Coach's Voice, and I find myself now where I think post lockdown, I'm starting to place more of an emphasis in indirect development where I'm, you know, if I'm cooking something or if I'm doing something, I'll stick on a webinar beside it. Someone of the staff members was the other day was laughing at me. I played two the same day and she came in and she's like, oh, Gary, you're very trying to improve yourself a lot today. But I just had to catch up on some stuff. And that's something that I don't think I was doing a year ago. Yeah. But I think now, like, hopefully we're at this nice space now where actually we're taking on the information and then being able to work with our players on it. So I want to keep that going because I don't think we'll look down the lockdown with as many happy memories. But I think the biggest positive has been some of these webinars. I'm not talking from like mine. Like, I was fortunate to get a few people on. It was great. But some of what other people have done as well, unbelievable.
Yeah. The great thing also about your platform is that the connections and networks it's made, because I've taken advantage of those. I've been on that platform and I've watched the video and I've seen the person's name and I've went to Twitter and I've followed them or I've DM'd them that big part for me. And I don't know if you've ever read the book Outliers by... Malcolm Gladwell, yeah. They talked about connectors. Oh, no, sorry, Tipping Point, sorry. Where he talks about connectors, salesmen and mavens. I would kind of see that platform for me is it's a connection. And I'm sure it's the same for a lot of coaches. I'm pretty sure that if you went down my Twitter list and you sort of sifted out the people who weren't in football and the people who are in football, that the connection would come back to the platform, or at least, you know, a good percentage of it would come back to the platform because that's how I used it. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that's done that. I'm sure there's been loads of coaches out there. The one that I picked up on most was Cam Meehan.
His content
is just a different level, isn't it? And I follow him and I talk about him to friends. I'm like, you need to follow this guy. But that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't got access to the platform and I hadn't seen it. And then, you know what I mean? So that whole connection piece, I think, is so, so strong with the platform.
Yeah, I think that's where I probably changed is... I don't know. Definitely not on purpose, but more as whenever I started, like my old website was GaryKernean.com, and then I was putting out sessions and stuff, but then you're like, it's all your work. So if someone doesn't like you, they're hardly going to go on your stuff, you know. And then you've only got enough time. But now it's become ModernSoccerCoach.com, and I can put up ideas from Jesse Marsh came on and it was unbelievable. But then, you know, he was 18 when he first came on, and you have a young, like someone who's just got some ideas to put up there. I think there's it gives them a little bit of, maybe it gives someone a little bit of a platform to get up and not I hate the word, like, raise their profile, but definitely get some connections, because as you know, like, a lot of the game is who you know, and some of that's fine, because you need to, you know, part of the game is getting out of your comfort zone, and part of the game is meeting people that you probably wouldn't have met, and part of the game is going up to people that you probably, again, from Northern Ireland, you probably think, oh, I should probably sit in the corner here and not say anything, but God, I'll chance my arm. So you have to, there's part of that as well that I want to promote.
Yeah, for sure. And for anyone who's listening, how can they get involved in that platform?
Just at modernsoccercoach.com. We've moved everything now to the website, trying to get everything up. Did a webinar yesterday, so that will probably be up in the next couple of days. Trying to get 2-3 articles up a week, and try to keep the webinars. Like, now I've got now people that have reached out and are volunteering to come up and do some stuff. So I try, and I'm really busy at the minute, where I try and work that in every couple of weeks. But just trying to keep it where, if you're a coach, similar to what Coach's Voice has done to me almost, where you need an idea or you need some inspiration of something, you can just log on.
Yeah, you can get you across all the socials as well. Is that right? Facebook, Twitter,
yeah. Instagram. So I don't do as much on Twitter now as what I was doing before. But Modern Soccer Coach, I try to keep it running.
Awesome. Perfect. And again, my testimony is I've told you what I think and how beneficial it's been for me. So I'm not going to speak from my experience of using the platform, but Gary's not paying me either to say this. this is personal experience. So if you are listening and you are thinking about potentially pre-season, it's happened last night. My webinar was about pre-season planning and session planning. So it's definitely worth it. So to finish off the podcast, Gary, I've got three questions that I like to try and ask everybody.
Yeah.
Not all of them make the cut.
Yeah, no problem. But
I'll go with it anyway. So the first question I'd ask is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given and why?
The best piece of advice I've ever been given was probably from my dad, who said, just always do extra. Something that was so, like, he applied it to everything. I wouldn't say that it wasn't like the Danny Alves story, you know, it wasn't as inspirational as that. But if you're out training and you're practicing by yourself, it's always, you know, get another 20, 30 minutes in. And now it's almost where I even catch myself thinking about it. If I'm putting together a piece of work and something would take you an extra 20 minutes for an animation, or you think something can pop up there, and your natural self. So my natural self was like, ah, you know, let's just turn this thing in and let's get it. But then I'm always thinking of my dad's in the background going, just do the bit extra. And it's almost for me a little bit of quality control, and taking the care to make sure that what you're doing has quality. And I think that probably more as a coach than it did as a player, to where it's making sure that if I'm putting anything together, that I've at least confident in that it's my best work.
Yeah, I love that, because it builds on something we spoke about in the last podcast, from the book Legacy by James Kerr. A friend of mine, John, and I done a book review of that, and they talk about Kiwi Kaizen as continuous improvement. You know, never be satisfied with what you have, always keep improving. And that whole idea of what your dad was saying about do the extra, do the next thing that has to be done. I love that. So what's the best or the biggest lesson that you found over either life or of your career that's helped really drive you on?
Biggest lesson. Yeah. I don't think there's been any moment, that's like a turning point for me. I'd say like most people, family is really, really important, and trying to balance that there with soccer and career is sometimes a challenge. So it's almost like, for me, it's trying to be happy of where you're at, and happy of it's sometimes it's an industry that you do work a lot, and you do, like I say, experience setbacks for probably the majority of the time. So you're trying to make sure that you're not just like you're, and happy might be the wrong word, because it's not that I'm definitely not one of these people that walks around with a smile on my face laughing and giggling all day, but it's just something that gets this inner part that enjoys where you are and what you're doing. And I probably have prioritized that more in the last 2 years, where it's now something that it's a core value to me, to where if I'm going to do something, or if I'm going to be somewhere, I'm going to enjoy who I'm with, and I'm going to give it everything I've got, and not just physically, but mentally and emotionally as well. And then I also, I was talking to one of our Japanese players about this the other day, about the fact of understanding the energy that you are responsible for when you walk into a room, and trying to improve that all the time. So basically just getting yourself in a good headspace. Stuff that you can't measure it, and you don't really know sometimes what it is, but I think it's so, so important. And I think as a coach, when you're coming in and you're interacting with staff, or you're interacting with people as young players, I think it's something that, again, the information is vital, but like the way that you deliver and the way that you carry yourself is probably, for me, that's something that I'm learning and trying to get better at.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point what you made there about the balance between family and your career and what it is you want to try and go for. I've had many conversations with friends about this, because in my close friend circle, I'm the only one that isn't married, doesn't have a child.
Oh, wow.
Right. So I can go and do what I want when I want to do it. And I sometimes have to remember and think, actually, well, I can't expect, I'm not going to name him, but I can't expect such and such to go do this with me, because he's got all those other family commitments and I don't. So I kind of have to have that awareness as well, and say to myself, you know what, I can't expect others to do what I can do, because I've got the freedom. I'm not too sure if they wish they had my freedom or not, but that's a different story. But I do get what you're talking about, the balance, you know?
Yeah.
So just to finish this off then, it's a selfish one on my part, because reading's a big part of my own self-development. That's what I love to do. What book or books have you read that you would recommend for others?
You mentioned Malcolm Gladwell before. Massive. Actually, I was listening to his podcast this morning. I love the way that he can take your mind somewhere and these beliefs that you have, and then even common sense beliefs that you're thinking, yep, that's what I believe. And then 30 minutes later or 25 pages later, you start to question it. And an hour later or four chapters later, you start to think that you're stupid. So I like books that challenge your thinking. My all-time favorite's the Gold Mine from Rasmus Ankersen. And it's someone that, it was so simple, but like I used to think environments, and again, like fixed thinking. I used to think growth mindset. This, again, for my wife was probably has challenged a lot of you're not as positive thinking as you think you are. You're not as growth mindset as you think you are. But the biggest example of that was, like, I did think that people were better in this country because they were born in this country. And only recently that I was like, reading that book thinking, oh my, like Kenyan runners, like they actually train differently than everyone else. So and I like the way that he's tried to move, or he's moved into football, and he's brought some of that into environments at Midland and Brentford. So that was a book that I really, really enjoyed. I'd say from a football standpoint, the Bergkamp book is probably my favorite of all time. But I read the Van Basten one in at Christmas, and that's something that it was he hated management, and I think every coach could actually relate to it without saying it out loud. But there's aspects of the job to where some days that you're thinking, is this my calling? Do I really, can I be successful at this? Insecurities, stuff like that there. He was so upfront about it, the injuries and stuff like that there. So that's where I try to go back. Like I'm the bad person to ask about books, because I finish like the least amount of books anyone. I pick up about five of them and leave them all over the house. But I try to go and read footballers' books now, but not like the glossy ones that, you know, like a footballer with a perspective where, and I think going back to my career journey has been, now working with players where I'm trying to get a bit more emphasis. Like I would love to try and create independent thinkers and critical thinkers. But I think in order for me to help, or for me to develop that there, I have to be more aware of how independent thinkers are created, and that involves probably less coaching. So now I'm reading, I'm reading Pirlo's book now, who is like one of the all-time independent thinkers, and that's something that I'm always trying to work in. So don't know if I'm a good person to ask about.
Well, the reason why I ask is because I've had this conversation plenty of times with friends of mine who coach, and even people outside the game, that they know that I'm an avid reader and they know that I like to read. But if I'm asked, you know, name me the last coaching book that you read, or the last book related to football you read, honestly, I'd struggle to tell you.
Yeah.
I'm reading Bomber Mafia right now, the new book by Gladwell, and I'm absolutely loving it. I'm reading Ego.
I didn't know he had a new book out.
I didn't know either until I caught him on, just by absolute chance, on his Revisionist History podcast. He'd done one with Adam Grant, and he mentioned it in there. I was like, I didn't know that was out. So I'm straight onto iBooks onto the iPad and download it on the iBooks. I'm reading it, and I'm reading Ego is the Enemy. I love Ryan Holiday's stuff. I'm really into Stoicism and the Stoic mindset, and he's a fantastic thinker. But what I was getting to was that my bookshelf, probably it's got Ferguson's book on it, Leading, and it's got Brian Clough's. And I've read both. Brian Clough's the original, not the ones that have come out recently. This one from like early 90s, I think it is. But that's kind of where I'm going towards my reading. Is I'm starting to think a little along the lines of you in terms of reading more footballers' books and more sort of understanding that lifestyle, the mindset, the challenges, and everything else that comes with it. Because I think it would be beneficial.
I was talking to one of our coaches about this last week. A lot of coaching books are theory, and I've written a couple of them, and I'd put them in the same category. You're theory based, you know, and you're always going to pick best practice. And you're always going to try and advise coaches to move in a certain. And I think sooner or later, you know, not that that message can wear off, but sooner or later you need to experience. You know, you'll work with different players, and you'll work with the reality of the game is that environments are really, really tough, and that's where the thing that I've moved away from completely is non-contextual leadership books, which is like. Anyone who disagrees with this way, get them out and move on. The people that disagreed would have been the best people. Like, what are you going to do when Maradona tells you to F off? Like, you're going to tell him, it's all right, Diego, we'll go to the World Cup. No, you're going to have to deal with it. So that's, to me, it's interesting. That's where I think when you read about McGrath's book or Tony Adams' book, and you're like, these players had some seriously complex lifestyle and issues. And sometimes even George Best, I was watching a documentary, an old one. I was rewatching it like a week or two ago, and I was just going down memory lane. And Best is talking about like Matt Busby and how he was such a father figure, but like Busby just didn't. He just sat and listened to him and was the first person to come and see him in the hospital and stuff like that. And little things that sometimes we think that coaching is pep, like it's inverting your wingers and making this system and doing all that. But sometimes it's just helping people or supporting people or listening to people.
Yeah. And I totally agree with what you said. And it's a fantastic way to end off the podcast episode. And I want to say a huge thank you for giving your time up. Because like I said, I know you're in season at the minute. And you just mentioned you're doing a bit of work this morning. So taking the time out to go on the podcast, really, really appreciate it. We've already let the listeners know how they can get involved in the Modern Soccer Coach platform. If you want to get in contact with me, and I can push them in contact with you as well, or likewise, jump on the Modern Soccer Coach website, just stick it under Google, you'll find it, it's all there. So thank you so much, and wish you all the very best for the season.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, it's been great chatting, and keep up the great work.